Chapter 10. Many a Marvelous Shrine. The sight of the Shadow Market sent a punch of familiarity through Kit's chest. It was a typical Los Angeles night. The temperature had dropped as soon as the sun set, and the cool wind blew through the empty lot where the market was, making the dozens of fairy bells that hung from the corners of the white-canopied booths chime. Ty had been full of suppressed excitement all the way there in the back of the Uber car, which he dealt with by pushing up the sleeve of Kit's shirt and giving him several runes. Kit had three of them, night vision, agility, and one called talent, which Ty told him would make him more persuasive. Now they were standing at the circumference of the market, having been dropped off in Kendall Alley. They were both dressed as mundanely as possible, in jeans, zip-front jackets, and fry boots. But Ty was still visibly a shadow hunter. He held himself like one, he walked like one, and looked like one, and there were even runes visible on the delicate skin of his neck and wrists. And bruises, too. All over the sides of his hands. The kind no mundane boy would have any business getting, unless he was in an illegal fight club. It wouldn't have mattered if he could have covered them up, though. Shadow hunters seemed to bleed their angel heritage through their pores. Kit wondered if he himself did yet. "I don't see any gates," Ty said, craning his head. "The gates are metaphysical, not exactly real," Kit explained. They were walking toward the section of the market where potions and charms were sold. A booth covered in tumbling roses in shades of red and pink and white sold love charms. One with a green and white awning sold luck and good fortune, and a pearly gray stand hung with curtains of lace, providing privacy, sold more dangerous items. Necromancy and death magic were both forbidden in the market, but the rules had never been strictly enforced. A puka was leaning against the post of a nearby street lamp, smoking a cigarette. Behind him, the lanes of the market looked like small, glowing streets, enticing Kit with calls of, "Come! Buy!" Voices clamored, jewelry clinked and rattled, spice and incense perfumed the air. Kit felt a longing mixed with anxiety. He cut a quick sideways glance toward Ty. They hadn't entered the market yet. Was Ty thinking about how much he'd hated the London market? How it had made him sweat and panic with too much noise, too much light, too much pressure, too much everything. He wanted to ask Ty if he was all right, but he knew the other boy wouldn't want it. Ty was staring at the market, tense with curiosity. Kit turned to the puka. "Gatekeeper," he said. "We request entrance to the Shadow Market." Ty's gaze snapped to attention. The puka was tall, dark, and thin, with bronze and gold strands threaded through his long hair. He wore purple trousers and no shoes. The lamppost he leaned against was between two stalls, neatly blocking the way into the market.
"Kit Rook," said the puka. "What a compliment it is, to still be recognized by one who's left us to dwell among the angels."
"He knows you," muttered Ty. "Everyone in the Shadow Market knows me," said Kit, hoping Ty would be impressed. The puka stubbed out his cigarette. It released a sickly, sweet smell of charred herbs.
"Password," he said.
"I'm not saying that," said Kit. "You think it's funny to try to make people say that?"
"Say what? What's the password?" Ty demanded.
The puka grinned. "Wait here, Kit Rook," he said, and melted back into the shadows of the market.
"He's going to get hail," said Kit, trying to hide the signs of his nerves.
"Can they see us?" Ty said. He was looking into the Shadow Market, where clusters of downworlders, witches, and other assorted members of the magical underworld moved among the clamor.
"Out here?" It was like standing outside a lighted room in the dark, Kit thought. And though Ty might not express it that way, Kit suspected he felt the same.
"If they can, they'd never show it," he said.
Ty turned toward him suddenly. His gaze slipped over Kit's ear, his cheekbone not quite meeting his eyes. "Watson."
"Kit Rook and Ty Blackthorn,"
snapped a voice out of the shadows.
It was Barnabas Hale, head of the market.
Actually, I'm assuming you're not actually Kit Rook and Ty Blackthorn, because they'd never be stupid enough to show up here.
That seemed like a compliment, said Ty, who looked honestly surprised.
Sure, maybe it's not us, said Kit. Maybe someone just got the specifications for the candygram you ordered wildly off.
Hale frowned in annoyance. He looked like he always had, short and scaly-skinned, with a snake's slit-pupiled eyes. He wore a pinstriped suit that Kit assumed must have been heavily altered to fit. Most humans weren't 3 feet tall and 3 feet wide. The Pooka had returned with Hale. Silently, he leaned against the lamppost again, his dark eyes glittering.
"Prove you're Kit Rook," said Hale. "What's the password?"
"I'm still not saying it. I'm never going to say it," said Kit.
"What is it?" Ty demanded.
"Just let us in," said Kit. "We don't want any trouble."
Hale barked out a laugh.
"You don't want trouble? You two? You've got to be kidding me. Do you know what kind of mayhem you caused in London? You wrecked property, attacked vendors, and you," he pointed at Ty, "destroyed a great deal of Faye's stock. I hate you both. Go away."
"Hear me out," said Kit. "Remember when that fairy burned half the market down and was welcomed back the next year because she had a bumper crop of hen's teeth?
Remember the werewolf and the llama and how that turned out? And he wasn't banned because he had a line on a supply of yenfen."
"What's your point?" said Hale. He sighed. "God, I wish I had a cigar. Had to quit."
"The spirit of the market is simple," said Kit. "Everything's okay as long as you make a profit, right?"
"Sure," said Hale. "And that's why we tolerated Johnny Rook." "We tolerated you because the Shadow Hunters hadn't found you yet." "But now they have, and it's a hop, skip, and a jump until you find out who you really are."
"What's that supposed to mean?" said Ty. The wind had picked up and was blowing his dark hair like streamers.
"Nothing for free," said Hale, with the annoyance of a man who'd said too much and who wanted a cigar and couldn't have one. "Besides, your money is no good here, Rook."
He waved a hand in Ty's direction.
"I might be able to get something exchanged for your skinny friend in the right circles, but not enough."
"Theoretically, how much?" asked Ty with interest.
Hale looked grim.
"Not as good a price as I'd get for Emma Carstairs. Even more for just her head."
Ty blanched. Kit felt it. Ty's recollection of the market was, in fact, truly dangerous, that it was all truly dangerous. Kit felt the situation was getting away from him.
"No heads, look. My father didn't trust anyone, Mr. Hale. You know that. He hid his most precious items all over Los Angeles, buried in places he thought no one would ever find them."
"I'm listening," said Hale.
Kit knew this was the risky part.
"One is right here in the Shadow Market. A ruby-encrusted copy of the Red Scrolls of Magic."
The Pooka whistled long and low.
"Not only will I give it to you, I'll give it to you for free," said Kit. "All you have to do is let us back into the Shadow Market. Free trade."
Hale shook his head in regret.
"Now I really wish I had a cigar so I could celebrate," he said. "I already found that, you stupid brat. We dug up your dad's stall after the Mantids killed him."
He turned away, then paused, glanced back over his shoulder. The moonlight seemed to bounce off his white, scaled skin.
"You're out of your depth, kids. Get out of Downworld before someone kills you. That person could even be me."
The forked tongue shot from between his teeth and licked his lips. Kit started back, revolted, as Hale melted into the market and was swallowed up by the crowds. Kit couldn't look at Ty. He felt as if the air had been knocked out of him, shock and shame warring for an equal chance to turn his stomach. He began.
"You should have just given the password," said the Pooka.
Out of patience, Kit slowly raised his middle finger.
"Here's your password."
Ty muffled a laugh and grabbed Kit's sleeve.
"Come on," he said. "Let's get out of here."
I am proud to announce, said Horace Dearborn, that the proposed Downworld Registry is ready to become a reality.
The sound that went through the rows of Nephilim seated in the council hall was hard to decipher. To Diana, it sounded like the roar of an animal driving another hungry beast away from its prey. Horace stood with his hands folded behind his back, a toneless smirk on his face. At his left stood Zara in full Centaurian regalia, her hair braided in a crown around her head. At his right was Manuel, his expression carefully blank, his eyes dancing with malice. They looked like a horrible mockery of a family portrait.
All institutes will have a short amount of time to register their local downworlders, said Horace. The heads of institutes must meet a quota of registrations based on our knowledge of local downworld populations. In the first weeks, this law takes effect.
Diana sat, letting the words wash over her in waves of horror. She couldn't help but look at Gia, who occupied a tall wooden seat at the edge of the dais. Her face was a strained mask. Diana couldn't help but wonder if this was more extreme even than what Gia had feared Horace might propose.
And if the downworlders refuse,
called someone from the audience.
Then they will have their protections under the accords stripped from them, Zara said,
and Diana went cold all over. No accords protection meant a shadow hunter could kill a downworlder in the street for no reason, and there would be no consequences.
We understand this will be a great burden of work on institutes, but it is important that everyone cooperate for the good of all shadow hunters. Each downworlder registered will be given a number, said Horace. If a downworlder is stopped by a shadow hunter for any reason, anywhere, they can be asked for this number.
The noise in the room was decidedly more worried now.
Think of it as an identification card, said Manuel. Safety and accountability are two of our chief concerns. I want to hear from the consul, shouted Carmen Delgado Mendoza, head of the Mexico City Institute, from the audience.
She was Christina's mother, and looked more than a little bit like her daughter.
Horace looked annoyed. Technically, as the one proposing a new law, he had the floor and could speak for a certain number of minutes uninterrupted. Diana felt he had already been speaking for several years. He gestured ungraciously toward Gia, who gripped the arms of her chair tightly.
It is my opinion that this law is not a good idea, she said. Downworlders will resist what they will see to be a major overreach on the part of the Nephilim. It establishes an atmosphere of mistrust.
That's because we don't trust them, said Manuel.
There was a gale of laughter from the back of the room. Diana could stand it no longer. She rose to her feet.
I have a question for the Inquisitor.
Horace looked at her with hooded eyes.
We will take questions and comments later, Diana.
Diana didn't like the emphasis he put on her name, as if he found it distasteful. Probably Zara had told her father a pack of lies about Diana. Diana had once humiliated Zara in front of her fellow Centaurians. Narcissists like Zara didn't forget insults.
Let her speak, said Gia. Everyone on the council has a voice.
Intensely aware of the eyes on her, Diana said,
This may seem like a small action, but it's not going to seem small to downworlders. It will have repercussions. Even if the registry is temporary, there will always be reasons to continue it. It is far harder to dismantle this sort of structure than it is to build it. We could face a situation where downworlders insist that shadow hunters also be registered, for parity. Are you prepared to have Nephilim carry their papers everywhere with them?
This had the desired effect. The council burst into angry buzzing.
No, never,
Dearborn snapped.
Then this effectively creates an underclass of downworlders, said Diana. We will have rights that they don't. Think about that.
Why are you so bothered by that idea, Diana Rayburn? Said Manuel in his soft, charming voice.
His eyes glittered like marbles.
Is there a downworlder, perhaps dear to you, that you worry will be affected?
Many shadow hunters have downworlders that are dear to them, said Diana evenly.
You cannot cleanly sever us from a group of human beings who have more in common with us than mundanes do.
Diana knew the answer to that. We're not afraid of mundanes. It's downworlders we fear, and we seek to control what we fear. But it was unlikely Horace had that kind of self-awareness. He glared at her with open loathing as she took her seat.
This is clearly a complex issue, said Gia, rising to her feet. I suggest we stay this vote for a week until the council has had time to come to terms with all its ramifications.
Horace transferred his glare to her, but said nothing. The council was now a hum of relief, and even Horace Dearborn knew better than to fly directly in the face of popular opinion during a vote. He stayed on the dais as the meeting was dismissed, his supporters flocking around him in a thick crowd. Feeling inexpressibly weary, Diana made for the exits. She felt as if she had been called to witness a bloody execution, only to see the victim spared for a week. Relief mixed with fear of what the future would bring.
Diana, said a light, accented voice behind her.
Diana turned to see one of the women from the Barcelona Institute, Trini Castell, approach her. She put a bird-like hand on Diana's arm.
I was inspired by what you said, Miss Rayburn, she said. You are correct that rights, anyone's rights, are not to be discarded lightly.
Thank you, said Diana, more than a little surprised.
Trini Castell gave her a quick smile and scurried away, leaving Diana with a clear view of the dais. Zara stood at its edge, her gaze fixed on Diana. In the pale light filtering through the window, the naked hatred on her face, far more than anyone might feel over a past insult, was clear as day. Shuddering, Diana turned and hurried from the hall.
Katerina's suspicious confluence of ley lines turned out to be in a small desert park near the Antelope Valley Freeway, famous for its massive sandstone formations. Both Helen and Aline seemed faintly surprised that Mark and Christina were planning to go out on patrol, but they hadn't done anything to stop them, as if they reluctantly acknowledged that patrolling was a normal part of Shadowhunter life, and the sooner everyone got back to normal life, the better. The drive from Malibu, they'd taken Diana's truck, which had been left in the parking lot of the Institute, reminded Christina of long ambling road trips she'd taken with Emma. Windows down in the truck, music playing low on the speakers, beach turning to highway, turning to desert, as the sun went down in a haze of fire. Mark had his long legs up on the dashboard and would sometimes turn his head to look at her as they rolled along in silence. The weight of his gaze felt like skin against her skin, like a touch. The Vasquez Rocks Park closed at sunset, and the dirt parking lot was empty when Christina cruised the truck into it and turned off the engine. They collected their weapons from the back of the truck, snapping on wrist protectors and buckling weapons belts. Christina strapped a long sword and her trusted balisong to her belt, while Mark found a ruined black whip and cracked it a few times. He wore a look of pleasure on his face as it snaked across the darkening sky. They had ruined themselves before they left. Christina could see Mark's night vision rune gleaming black against his throat as they passed under the lights of the ranger station and crossed into a dirt path that wound through scrub among rocks that twisted and folded like envelopes. Christina breathed deeply. Of all the things she loved about California, she loved the scent of the desert the most, clear air mixed with juniper, manzanita, and sage. The sky opened above them like a secret told, scattered with a million stars. They passed a wooden sign for a trail just as a massive rock formation rose ahead of them, nearly blocking out the moon. The ley line confluence, Mark said, pointing. Christina didn't ask him how he knew. Fairies had a sense for such things. They moved closer to the rocks, which rose above them in tilted slabs, like the remains of a spaceship that had crashed into the sand. Christina's boots crunched into the sand, the sound loud in her ears thanks to her audio rune. A sharp insect-like sound buzzed behind her,
She turned, Mark frowning at the sensor in his hand. It's making a buzzing noise, but not one I've heard before, he said. Christina turned around slowly. The desert stretched around her, a carpet of black and brown and dim gold. The sky was dark velvet.
I don't see anything.
We should wait here, said Mark. See if it happens again. Christina was in no mood to hang around under the romantic moon with Mark.
I think we should keep moving.
Christina, Mark said, you seem wroth with me. Christina rolled her eyes.
Nothing gets by you, Mark Blackthorn.
Mark lowered the sensor.
Last night. It wasn't that I didn't want to. I did want to.
Christina blushed furiously.
It's not that, Mark, she said. You can want to or not want to. It's your business. It was that you lied.
Humans lie, he said, his bicolored eyes suddenly blazing. Mortals lie to each other every day, especially in matters of love. Is it that my lie wasn't good enough? Should I be more practiced?
No, she whirled on him. I like that you don't lie, Mark. It is why I was so... Mark, can't you understand? I didn't expect you to lie to me.
You saw me lie to Kieran, he said.
Yes, but that was to save lives, she said.
Unless you're telling me that you not wanting to have sex with me has something to do with saving lives, which I find hard to believe.
I did want to, Mark exploded. One thing you must understand. I did want to be with you in that way, and always, and that is not a lie.
Christina sank down on a low rock. Her heart was pounding, and she just said the word sex, which horribly embarrassed her.
Then I don't understand why you did it, she said in a small voice. Were you trying to spare someone? Kieran?
I was trying to spare you, he said, his voice dark and hard, like late winter ice.
Spare me what?
You know who you are, he cried, startling her. She looked up at him, not understanding. It was not as if she were a stranger to him, or to anyone. What did he mean?
Kieran called you a princess of the Nephilim, and rightly, he said.
The moon was out fully, and the silver-white light illuminated his hair like a halo. It illuminated his eyes, too, wide and gold and blue and full of pain.
You are one of the best examples of our people I have ever known. Shining, righteous, virtuous. You are all of the good things I can think of, and all of the things I would like to be, and no, I never can. I do not want you to do anything that later you would regret. I do not want you to later realize how far down from your standards you reached. When you reached for me.
Mark! She bolted up from the rock and went over to him. She heard a thump as something hit the ground and threw her arms around Mark, hugging him tightly. For a moment he held himself stiff and frozen. Then he softened against her, his arms encircling her body, his lips brushing her cheek, the soft curls of her hair that had escaped from her braid.
Christina, he whispered.
She drew back enough to touch his face, her fingers tracing the lines of his cheekbones. His skin had that impossible fairy smoothness that came from never having needed the touch of a razor.
Mark Blackthorn, she said, and shivered deep in her bones at the look in his eyes. I wish you could see yourself as I see you.
You are so many things I never thought to want, but I do want them.
I want all things with you.
His arms tightened around her. He gathered her to him, as if he were gathering an armful of flowers. His lips skated along her cheek, her jawline. At last their mouths met, burning hot in the cold air, and Christina gave a little gasp at the desire that shot through her, sharp as an arrowhead. He tasted like honey and fairy wine. They staggered backward, fetching up against a rock pile. Mark's hands were on her gear jacket. He was undoing it, sliding his hands inside, under her shirt, as if desperate for the touch of her skin. He murmured words like, beautiful and perfect. and she smiled and swiped her tongue slowly across his bottom lip, making him gasp as if she had stabbed him. He groaned helplessly and pulled her tighter. The sensor buzzed, loud and long. They sprang apart, gasping. Christina zipped her jacket with shaking hands as Mark bent awkwardly to seize the sensor. It buzzed again, and they both whirled, staring.
No mames, she whispered.
The buzzer made another insistent noise, and something hit her hard from the side. It was Mark. He knocked her to the ground. They both rolled sideways over the bumpy, pitted earth as something massive and shadowy rose above them. Black wings spread like ragged shadows. Christina shoved herself up on her elbow, yanked a ruined dagger from her belt, and flung it. There was a cawing scream. Witchlight filled the sky. Mark was on his knees, a runestone in his hand. Above them, a massive, white-faced demon, trailing feathers like a shadowy cloak of rags, flapped its wings, the hilt of Christina's dagger protruding from its chest. Its outline was already beginning to blur as it screeched again, clawing at the hilt with the taloned claw, before folding up like paper and vanishing.
Happy a demon, said Mark, leaping to his feet.
He reached down to help Christina up after him. Probably hiding in the rocks. That's where the sensor didn't pick it up well.
We should go, Christina glanced around. Judging by the sensor, there are more.
They began to jog toward the dirt trail, Christina glancing back over her shoulder to see if anything was following them.
I just want to make it clear that I did not engineer the interruption of the Harpia demon, Mark said, and was eager to continue our sexual congress.
Christina sighed.
Good to know.
She cut sideways through some low sagebrush. In the far distance, she could see the metal gleam of the parked truck. Mark's footsteps slowed.
Christina, look. She glanced around.
I don't see.
Look down, he said, and she did.
She remembered thinking that her boots had crunched oddly in the sand. Now she realized it was because it wasn't sand. A bleak moonscape stretched out around them in a 20-foot radius. The succulent plants and sagebrush were withered, gray-white as old bones. The sand looked as if it had been blasted with wildfire, and the skeletons of jackrabbits and snakes were scattered among the rocks.
It is the blight, said Mark, the same blight we saw in Ferry.
But why would it be here? Christina demanded, bewildered. What do ley lines have to do with the blight? Isn't that fairy magic? Mark shook his head.
I don't.
A chorus of shrieking howls ripped through the air. Christina spun, kicking up a cloud of dust, and saw shadows rising up out of the desert all around them. Now Christina could see them more closely. They resembled birds, only in that they were winged.
What looked like feathers were actually trailing black rags that swathed their gaunt white bodies.
Their mouths were so stuffed with crooked, jagged teeth that it looked as if they were grotesquely smiling. Their eyes were popping yellow bulbs with black dot pupils.
But the sensor, she whispered. It didn't go off. It didn't.
Run, Mark said, and they ran, as the Harpia demons soared, screeching and laughing into the sky. A rock thumped to the ground near Christina, and another barely missed Mark's head. Christina longed to turn and plunge her bally song into the nearest demon, but it was too hard to aim while they were both running. She could hear Mark cursing as he dodged rocks the size of baseballs. One slammed painfully into Christina's hand as they reached the truck, and she jerked the door open. Mark climbed in the other side, and for a moment they sat gasping as rocks pounded down onto the truck's cab like hailstones.
Diana's not going to be happy about her car, said Mark. We have bigger problems.
Christina jammed the keys into the ignition. The truck started with a jerk, rolling backward, and stopped. The sound of the rocks pounding the metal roof had ceased as well, and the silence seemed suddenly eerie.
What's going on?
She demanded, stomping down on the gas.
Get out, Mark shouted. We have to get out.
He grabbed hold of Christina's arm, hauling her over the center console. They both tumbled out of the passenger side door as the truck lifted into the air. Christina landing awkwardly half on top of Mark. She twisted around to see that the harpia demons had seized the truck, their claws puncturing the metal sides of the bed and digging into the window frames. The vehicle sailed into the air, the harpia demons shrieking and giggling as they hauled it up into the sky, and dropped it. It spun end over end and hit the ground with a massive crash of metal and glass, rolling sideways to lie upended on the sand. One of the harpia had ridden it down as if it were a surfboard and still crouched, snarking and cackling, on the frame of the upside-down truck. Christina leapt to her feet and stalked toward the truck. As she got closer, she could smell the stink of spilling gasoline. The harpia, too stupid to realize the danger, turned its dead-white, grinning face toward her.
"The rocks are our place," it hissed at her. "Poisoned, the best place."
"Kaliate," she snapped, unsheathed her long sword, and sliced off its head. Ichor exploded upward in the spray, even as the harpia's body folded up and winked out of existence. The other demons howled and dived. Christina saw one of them dive-bombing Mark and screamed his name. He leapt onto a rock and slashed out with his whip. Ichor opened a glowing seam across the harpia's chest, and it thumped to the sand, chittering. But another harpia was already streaking across the sky. Mark's whip curled around its throat, and he jerked hard, sending its head bumping like a tumbleweed among the rocks. Something struck Christina's back. She screamed as her feet left the ground. A harpia had sunk its claws into the back of her gear jacket and was lifting her into the air. She thought of stories about how eagles flew high into the sky with their prey and then released them, letting their bodies smash open on the earth below. The ground was already receding below her with terrifying speed. With a scream of fear and anger, she slashed up and backward with her sword, slicing the harpia's claws off at the joint. The demon shrieked, and Christina tumbled through the air, her sword falling out of her hand, reaching out as if she could catch onto something to slow her fall. Something seized her out of the sky. She gasped as a hand caught her elbow, and she was yanked sideways to land awkwardly atop something warm and alive. A flying horse. She gasped and scrabbled for purchase, digging into the creature's mane as it dipped and dived.
"Christina, stay still!"
It was Kieran shouting. Kieran was behind her, one arm lashing around her waist to pull her against him. What felt like an electric charge shot through her. Kieran was wild-eyed, his hair deep blue-black, and she realized suddenly that the horse was Windspear, even as the stallion shot downward through the crowd of harpia toward Mark.
"Kieran, look out!"
she cried as the harpia demons turned their attention to Windspear, their popping yellow eyes swiveling like flashlights. Kieran flung his arm out, and Christina felt the sharp electric charge go through her again. White fire flashed, and the harpia demons recoiled as Windspear landed lightly in front of Mark.
"Mark, to me!"
Kieran shouted. Mark looked over at him and grinned, a hunter's grin, a battle grin, all teeth, before decapitating the last harpia with a jerk of his whip. Spattered with blood and ichor, Mark leapt onto the horse behind Kieran, latching his arms around Kieran's waist. Windspear sprang into the air, and the harpia followed, their grinning mouths open to show rows of shark-like teeth. Kieran shouted something in a fairy language Christina didn't know, and Windspear tilted up at an impossible angle. The horse shot upward like an arrow, just as the truck below them finally exploded, swallowing the harpia demons in a massive corona of flames.
"Diana's going to be really angry about her truck," Christina thought, and slumped down against Windspear's mane as the fairy horse circled below the clouds, turned, and flew toward the ocean.
Kit had never been up on the roof of the Los Angeles Institute before. He had to admit it had a better view than the London Institute, unless you were a sucker for skyscrapers. Here, you could see the desert stretching out behind the house, all the way to the mountains. Their tops were touched by light reflecting from the city on the other side of the range, their valleys in deep shadow. The sky was brilliant with stars. In front of the house was the ocean,
its immensity terrifying and glorious. Tonight the wind was like light fingers stroking its surface, leaving trails of silver ripples behind.
You seem sad, said Ty. Are you? They were sitting on the edge of the roof, their legs dangling into empty space. This was probably the way he was supposed to live his high school years, Kit thought, climbing up onto high places, doing dumb and dangerous things that would worry his parents. Only he had no parents to worry, and the dangerous things he was doing were truly dangerous. He wasn't worried for himself. He was worried for Ty. Ty, who was looking at him with concern, his gray gaze skating over Kit's face, as if it were a book he was having trouble reading. Yes, I'm sad, Kit thought. I'm stuck and frustrated. I wanted to impress you at the shadow market, and I got so caught up in that I forgot about everything else. About how we really shouldn't be doing this. About how I can't tell you we shouldn't be doing this. Ty reached out and brushed Kit's hair away from his face. An absent sort of gesture that sent a shock of something through Kit. A feeling like he'd touched a live electrical fence. He stared, and Ty said, You ought to get your hair cut. Julian cuts Tabby's hair.
Julian's not here, said Kit.
I don't know if I want him cutting my hair.
He's not bad at it, Ty dropped his hand. You said your dad had stuff hidden all over Los Angeles. Is there anything that could help us?
Your dad. As if Julian was Ty's father. Then again, he was, in a way.
Nothing necromantic, said Kit. Ty looked disappointed. Still dizzy from the electric fence shock, Kit couldn't stand it. He had to fix it, that look on Ty's face.
Look, we tried the straightforward approach. Now we have to try the con.
I don't really get cons, said Ty. I read a book about them, but I don't understand how people let themselves get tricked like that.
Kit's eyes dropped to the gold locket around Ty's neck. There was still blood on it. Looked like patches of rust.
It's not about making people believe what you want them to believe. It's about letting them believe what they want to believe. About giving them what they think they need.
Ty raised his eyes. Though they didn't meet Kit's, Kit could read the expression in them. The dawning awareness.
Does he realize? Kit thought in mingled relief and apprehension.
Ty sprang to his feet. I have to send a fire message to Hypatia Vex, he said. This was not at all what Kit had expected him to say.
Why? She already said no to helping us.
She did, but Shade says she's always wanted to run the shadow market herself. Ty smiled sideways, and in that moment, despite their difference in coloring, he looked like Julian.
It's what she thinks she needs.
The sky was a road, and the stars made pathways. The moon was a watchtower, a lighthouse that led you home. Being on Windspear's back was both utterly strange and utterly familiar to Mark. So was having his arms around Kieran. He had flown through so many skies holding Kieran, and the feeling of Kieran's body against his, the whipcord strength of him, the faint ocean salt scent of his skin and hair was mapped into Mark's blood. At the same time, he could hear Christina, hear her laughing, see her as she bent to point out landmarks flashing by beneath them. She had asked Kieran if they could fly over the Hollywood sign, and he had obliged. Kieran, who made a point of being disobliging. And Mark's heart stirred at her laugh. It stirred as he touched Kieran. He was between them again, as he had been in London. And though agitation prickled his nerves at the thought, he couldn't pretend he wasn't glad to have Kieran back again. Kieran brought Windspear down in the lot behind the Institute. Everything was still, broken only by the sound of chirping cicadas. It was hard to believe that 10 minutes previously they had been in a fight to the death with harpia demons.
Are you all right? Christina said with a frown as she slid from the horse's back. You don't look well.
With a start, Mark realized she was talking to Kieran, and that she was right. Kieran had arrived at the Vasquez Rocks almost crackling with energy.
It was the kind of wild, numinous magic Mark associated with the royal family, but had never seen Kieran employ before. But the energy seemed to have left him, and he leaned a hand against Winspear's side, breathing hard. There was blood on his hands, his collar and skin. His face was drained of color. Mark stepped forward, hesitated. He remembered Kieran telling him that they were done. "I didn't know you were hurt at the rocks, Kier," he said.
"No, this happened at the Scholomance."
"Why did you leave?" Christina asked.
"There's something I need to tell you."
Kieran winced and slapped Windspear on the flank. The horse wickered and trotted into the shadows, melting into the darkness. "First we must get you upstairs." Christina glanced at Mark as if she expected him to step forward and help Kieran. When he didn't, she moved to Kieran's side, curving his arm around her shoulder.
"We must see how badly you are wounded."
"It is important," Kieran began.
"So is this."
Christina moved forward with Kieran, leaning on her. Mark could no longer stand it. He swung around to Kieran's other side, and together they went into the house, Kieran limping between them.
"Thank you, Mark," Kieran said in a low voice.
When Mark chanced to glance sideways, he saw no anger in Kieran's eyes. But hadn't Kieran been angry the last time they'd been together? Had Kieran forgotten Mark had wronged him? It was not the nature of princes to forget wrongs or forgive them. Christina was saying something about water and food. Mark's mind was a whirl, and for a moment, when they stepped into the kitchen, he blinked around in confusion. He'd thought they were going to one of their rooms. Christina helped Mark get Kieran settled into a chair before going to the sink to get damp towels and soap.
"I must speak to you about what I've learned," Kieran was saying.
He was perched on the chair, all long limbs and dark, odd clothes and burning eyes. His hair shimmered deep blue. He looked like a fairy out of place in the human world, and it stabbed Mark through with a painful sympathy, mixed with a fear that he might look like that himself.
"Let me see your face."
Christina brushed Kieran with gentle fingers. He leaned into her touch, and Mark could not blame him.
"What's going on?"
Light blazed up in the kitchen. It was Helen, carrying a runestone in one hand.
"Is someone hurt?"
Mark and Christina exchanged startled looks. Kieran looked between Mark and Helen, his lips parting in realization.
"Were you waiting up for us?" Mark demanded. "It's past midnight." "I was not."
Helen looked down at her sweatpants guiltily.
"I wanted a sandwich."
She squinted at Kieran. "Did you trade in Diana's truck for a fairy prince?" Kieran was still looking at her with that same realization, and Mark knew what he must be seeing. Someone who was so clearly Mark's sister. So clearly the Helen that Mark had spoken about with such pain for so many years in the hunt. He rose to his feet and crossed the room to Helen. He lifted her free hand and kissed the back of it.
"The beloved sister of my beloved Mark, it is a joy to behold you well and reunited with your family."
"I like him," Helen said to Mark.
Kieran lowered her hand.
"May I share my sorrow at the passing of your sister Livia," he said. "It is a shame to see such a bright and beautiful star untimely extinguished."
"Yes," Helen's eyes glistened. "Thank you."
"I don't understand."
Mark felt as if he were in a dream. He had imagined Kieran meeting his family, but it had not been like this. And Kieran had never been so gracious, even in Mark's imagination.
"Perhaps we should all sit down," Helen said. "I think I'd better hear about what happened tonight on your normal patrol."
She raised an eyebrow at Mark.
"I must first tell you what befell at the Scholomance," said Kieran firmly. "It is imperative."
"What happened?" Christina said. "I thought it would be safe for you there."
"It was, for a short time," said Kieran. "Then the cohort returned from Idris and discovered me. But that story must wait. I came to bring you news."
He glanced around at their expectant faces.
"The Inquisitor of the Clave has sent Emma and Julian on a secret mission to Faerie.
They are not expected either to return or to survive. Mark felt numb all over. What do you mean? It is a dangerous mission. And someone has been sent after them to make sure they don't complete it. Gasping, Kieran slumped back in his chair, looking terribly pale. Mark and Christina both reached to steady him at the same time. They looked at each other in some surprise over Kieran's bowed head. "Kieran, you're bleeding!" Christina exclaimed, taking her hand away from his shoulder. It was stained red. "It's nothing," Kieran said roughly. Not a lie, precisely. Mark was sure he believed it, but his ashen face and feverish eyes told another story. "Kier, you're unwell," said Mark. "You must rest. You cannot do anyone any good in this condition." "Agreed," Christina stood up, her hand still red with Kieran's blood. "We must see to your wounds, at once."
"You have changed, son of thorns," said the queen. She had been silent for some minutes while the room emptied of guards and observers. Even then, Julian did not entirely believe that they were alone. Who knew what sprites or chloricons might be hiding among the shadows? Julian began pacing, impelled by a restlessness he couldn't explain. Then again, he could explain little of what he felt these days. There were impulses he followed, others he avoided, angers and dislikes and even hopes. But he could not have explained the emotion that led him to kill Dane, or what he felt afterward. It was as if the words he needed to describe what he had felt had disappeared from his mental vocabulary. He remembered someone had once told him that the last words of Sebastian Morgenstern had been, "I've never felt so light." He felt light himself. Having put down a weight of constant fear and longing he had grown so used to carrying, he no longer noticed it. But still, deep down, the thought of Sebastian chilled him. Was it wrong to feel lightness? He was conscious now of impatience and a knowledge, though it was distant, that he was playing with fire. But the knowledge did not come accompanied either by fear or by excitement. It was distant, clinical.
"We are alone," said the queen. "We could amuse ourselves."
Now he did look at her. Her throne had changed, and so had she. She seemed to be draped along the cushions of a red chaise, her coppery hair tumbling around her. She was radiantly beautiful, the gaunt outlines of her face filled in with youth and health, her brown eyes glowing. "The queen's eyes are blue. Emma's are brown." But it didn't change what he was seeing. The queen's eyes were the color of tiger's eye stones and shimmered as she gazed at him. Her dress was white satin, and as she slowly drew up one leg, sliding her toe along her opposite calf, it fell open at the slit, revealing her legs up to her hips.
"That's a glamour," Julian said. "I know what's underneath."
She rested her chin on her hand.
"Most people would not dare to speak that way to the Seelie Queen."
"Most people don't have something the Seelie Queen wants," said Julian.
He felt nothing, looking at her. She was beautiful, but he could not have desired her less if she'd been a beautiful rock or a beautiful sunset. She narrowed her eyes and they flickered back to blue.
"You are indeed different," she said. "More like a fairy."
"I'm better," he said.
"Really?"
The queen sat up slowly, her silken dress resettling around her.
"There is a saying among my people about the mortals we bring here. In the land of fairy, as mortals feel no sorrow, neither can they feel joy."
"And why is that?" asked Julian. She laughed.
"Have you ever wondered how we lure mortals to live amongst fairies and serve us, son of thorns? We choose those who have lost something and promise them that which humans desire most of all, a cessation to their grief and suffering. Little do they know that once they enter our lands, they are in a cage and will never again feel happiness. She leaned forward. You are in that cage, boy. A shiver went up Julian's spine. It was atavistic, primal, like the impulse that had driven him to climb Livy's pyre. You're trying to distract me, my lady. How about giving me what you promised? What do you mind about the Peribatai bond now? It seems you no longer care for Imar. I saw it in the way she looked at you, as if she missed you, even though you were standing beside her. The bonds, Julian said through his teeth. How can they be broken? His head throbbed. Maybe he was dehydrated. Very well, the queen leaned back, letting her long hair spill over the side of the chaise and down to the ground. Though it may not please you. Tell me. The Peribatai rune has a weakness that no other rune has, because it was created by Jonathan Shadowhunter rather than the angel Raziel, said the queen. As she spoke, she drew on the air with her fingertip in lazy spirals. Kept in the Silent City is the original Peribatai rune inscribed by Jonathan Shadowhunter and David the Silent. If it is destroyed, all the Peribatai runes in the world will be broken. Julian could hardly breathe. His heart was hammering against his chest. All the bonds in the world broken. He still couldn't explain what he was feeling, but the intensity of it made him feel as if he were bursting out of his own skin. Why would I not be pleased to hear that? He asked. Because it would be difficult? Not difficult. Impossible. Oh, it wasn't always impossible, said the queen, sitting up and smirking at him. When I spoke to you about it first, it was in good faith. But things have changed. What do you mean? Julian demanded. How have things changed? I mean, there is only one way to destroy the rune, the queen said. It must be cut, through and through, by the mortal sword.
Chapter 11. Some far-off, happier sea. The wound was long but not deep, a slice across Kieran's right upper arm. Kieran sat with his teeth gritted atop a bed in one of the Institute's empty guest rooms, his sleeve cut away by Christina's balisong. Mark leaned nervously against a nearby wall, watching. Christina had been a little surprised at how muscular Kieran's arm was. Even after he carried her through London, she'd thought of Ferries as delicate, fine-boned. And he was, but there was a toughness there, too. His muscles seemed more tightly wrapped against his bones than a human's, giving his body a lean, tensile strength. She finished carefully mopping the blood away from the cut and ran her fingers lightly over the skin around it. Kieran shivered, half closing his eyes. She felt guilty for causing him pain. I see no sign of infection or need for the wound to be stitched, she said. Bandaging it should do the trick. Kieran looked at her sideways. It was hard to discern his expression in the shadows. There was only one lamp in the room, and it was heavily shaded. I'm sorry to have brought this trouble to you, Kieran said in a soft voice. A nighttime voice, careful of waking those who might be sleeping. Both of you. You didn't bring us trouble, said Mark, his voice roughened with tiredness. You brought us information that can help us save lives of people we love. We're grateful. Kieran frowned, as if he weren't too fond of the word grateful. Before Christina could add anything, a cry split the night, a howl of miserable terror. Even knowing what it was, Christina shivered. Tavi, she said. He's having a nightmare, Mark confirmed. Poor child, said Kieran. The terrors of the night are grim indeed. He'll be all right, Mark said, though worry shadowed his expression. He wasn't there when Livy died, thank the angel, but I think he heard whispers. Perhaps we shouldn't have brought him to the funeral, to see the pyres.
I believe such things are a comfort, Christina said. I believe they allow our souls to say goodbye. The door creaked open, someone auto-seated the hinges, and Helen stuck her head in, looking distressed.
Mark, will you go to Tavi?
Mark hesitated.
Helen, I shouldn't. Please.
Helen leaned exhaustedly against the door jamb.
He's not used to me yet, and he won't stop crying.
I'll take care of Kieran, Christina said with more confidence than she felt. Mark followed Helen from the room with clear reluctance. Feeling awkward at being left alone with Kieran, Christina took a bandage from the kit and began to wind it around his upper arm. I always seem to end up tending your wounds, she said half-jokingly. But Kieran did not smile. That must be why, he said. Whenever I suffer, I now long for the touch of your hands. Christina looked at him in surprise. He was clearly more delirious than she had thought. She laid a hand on his forehead. He was burning up. She wondered what a normal temperature for fairies was.
Lie down. She tied off the bandage. You should rest.
Her hair swung forward as she bent over him. He reached up and tucked a lock behind her ear.
She went still, her heart thudding. I thought of you at the Scholomance, he said. I thought of you every time anyone used Diego's name. Rosales. I could not stop thinking of you. Do you want to? Her voice shook. Stop thinking of me.
He touched her hair again, his fingers light where they brushed her cheek. The sensation made goosebumps flood across her skin.
I know that you and Mark are together. I do not know where I fit into all of that.
His cheeks were fever-flushed.
I know how much I've hurt you both. I feel it down in my bones. I would never want to hurt either of you a second time. Tomorrow I will leave here, and neither of you need ever see me again.
No, Christina exclaimed with a force that surprised her.
Do not go, not alone.
Christina. His right hand came up to curve around her other cheek. He was cupping her face. His skin was hot. She could see the blotches of fever on his cheeks, his collarbone.
Princess, you will be better off without me.
I am not a princess, she said. She was leaning over him, one of her hands braced against the blanket. His face was close to hers, so close she could see the dark fringe of his eyelashes.
And I do not want you to go.
He sat up, his hand still cradling her face. She gave a little gasp and felt her own temperature spike at the warmth of his hands as they moved from her face to her shoulders, to the curve of her waist, drawing her toward him. She let herself fall on top of him, her body stretched along his, their hips and chests aligned. He was tense as a drawn bow, tight and arched beneath her. His hands were fever-hot, carding through her soft hair. She placed her palms against his hard chest. It rose and fell rapidly. Her mind was spinning. She wanted to press her lips against the fine skin over his cheekbone, graze his jaw with kisses. She wanted, and the wanting shocked her, the intensity of it. She had never felt such intensity for anyone but Mark. Mark. She drew away from Kieran, nearly tumbling to the coverlet.
Kieran, we shouldn't. You have a fever.
He rolled onto his side, eyes bright as he studied her.
I do have a fever, he said. I am not out of my mind, though. I've been wanting to hold you for a long time.
You haven't even known me that long, she whispered, though she knew she was lying in a very human way, hiding what she really meant behind irrelevancies. The truth was that she had wanted Kieran, too, and she suspected she had for some time.
Lie back. You need to rest. We will have plenty of time to talk more if you do not leave. She sat up. Promise me you won't leave.
Kieran's eyes were averted, his lashes like the rays of a dark star.
I should not stay. I will only bring sorrow to you and to Mark.
Promise me, Christina hissed.
I promise I will stay, he said at last. But I cannot promise that
You will not regret that I did.
Neen showed Emma into the room she and Julian had stayed in the last time they'd been in the Seely Court. The silvery quartz walls pulsed with low light, and the rose hedge Emma remembered was gone. Instead, the waterfall cascaded fiercely down the rock wall, as if powered by a flood, pouring into an unshaded pool several feet below the floor. "It's kind of Fergus to let us stay in his room," Emma said as Neen ushered her in.
"Fergus has no choice," said Neen serenely. "It's what the Queen desires."
Emma blinked. That seemed odd and not auspicious. Why did the Queen care where they stayed? Her gaze strayed over the rest of the room. There was a table she could put her bag down on. There was a sofa made of vines, twining closely together. She frowned. "Where's the bed?"
"Behind the waterfall, in Fergus's bower."
"His what?"
"His bower," Neen pointed.
Sure enough, a set of stone steps wound behind the curtain of the waterfall. Apparently Fergus liked to mix it up in the design area.
"What is wrong with the bower?"
"Nothing," said Emma. "I was thinking of getting one myself."
Neen gave her a suspicious look before leaving her alone. Emma heard the key turn in the lock as she shut the door, and didn't even bother to try the knob. Even if she escaped the room, she'd have no way of finding her way through the corridors. And it wasn't as if she'd go anywhere without Julian, who wanted to be here anyway. The last thing she felt like was sleeping, but she'd learned to snatch rest at any time on missions. She changed into her nightgown and mounted the stone steps behind the waterfall. They led to a stone platform, hidden behind the water. Despite her miserable mood, Emma was struck by the beauty of it. The bed was massive, piled with cloudy white cushions and a heavy coverlet. The waterfall sheeted by past the foot of the bed in a curtain of glimmering silver. The rush and roar of water surrounded the space, reminding Emma of the crash of waves against the beach. She sank down on the bed. "Nice room," she said to no one in particular. "Sorry, bower." "Time to sleep," she decided. She lay down and closed her eyes. But the first image that sprang up against her lids was the image of Julian holding Livy's body in the council hall, his face against her blood-wet hair. Emma's eyelids popped open, and she turned over restlessly. It didn't help. The next time she tried, she saw Dane's open, staring eyes as the kelpie sank its teeth into his body. Too much blood, too much horror. She wanted Julian badly. She missed him as if it had been a week since she'd seen him. In a way it had been. Even her parabatai rune felt strange. She was used to the pulse of its energy, but even before they had come to Ferry, reaching for that energy had been like slamming into a blank wall. She turned over again, wishing for Christina, who she could talk to. Christina, who would understand. But could she even tell Christina about the spell that had stripped Julian of his emotions? And what about his deal with the Queen? It had been an ugly sort of brilliant, she thought, to make a copy for the fair folk. They were both tricky and literal enough to at least consider the copy as sufficient for their purposes. It was too bad Julian couldn't simply have given the copy to Horace, but he would have laughed in their faces. Even a Dearborn knew what printer paper looked like. He didn't want to perform the spells in the book, after all. He simply wanted back the property he believed Annabelle had stolen, the black volume that had lived so many years on the shelves of the Cornwall Institute. She heard the door of the room open, voices, Julian's tread on the stairs, and then he was by the bed. She hadn't realized how the light pouring through the water would turn him into an effigy of silver. Even his dark hair was silvered, as if she was seeing him the way he might look in 30 years. She sat up. He didn't move or seem as if he were about to say anything. He stood looking at her, and when he raised his hand to push his hair back, she saw again the stained cloth tied around his wrist.
So how'd it go? She asked finally. Did you find out how to break all the parabatai bonds in the world?
As it turns out, it's not possible.
He leaned against a bedpost.
You must be pleased.
Yes. She kicked a pillow down to the foot of the bed. I mean, that's a relief. But I'm still curious why you suddenly decided to trust the Seelie Queen when she's literally never been trustworthy.
She didn't betray us before, said Julian. We made a deal with her, but we never brought her the Black Volume until now.
She did terrible things to Jason Clary.
Maybe they just didn't know how to deal with her properly. His blue-green eyes glittered. The Queen only cares about the Queen. She isn't interested in causing pain for the sake of causing it. She just wants what she wants. If you remember that, you can deal with her.
But why did we ever have to look?
It was obvious we couldn't trust Dearborn from the beginning. This isn't just a secret mission like Clary and Jace's. He brought us to Brosland alone. He sent us through the door to Ferry without anyone else there. Horace Dearborn is not on our side, Julian said. He thinks we're enemies, downworlder lovers. Sure, he thinks we can get the Black Volume back for him. But he planned for us to die doing it. What do you think happens, Emma, when we go home, if we don't have it? In fact, how do you think we even get back? Do you really feel like we can trust some guy standing at Brahm's crossroads on Horace's orders?
She'd been so caught up in anger at Julian, she hadn't stopped to think about how they might get home from Ferry. Dane said it wasn't just him, she said. Do you think he meant there'll be someone waiting at Brahm's crossroads to kill us?
There could be someone waiting around every corner to kill us, Julian said. Dane was an idiot. He came for us too fast, before we had the real book. But they may not all be. Our lives are in danger here, every second. If we have a deal with the Queen, we're under her protection.
We need an ally, Emma said. And she's weird and opportunistic and terrible, but better than nothing. That's what you're saying?
Every plan involves risk, Julian said. Not going to the Queen was a risk. Strategy is choosing between risks. There is no safe way, Emma, not for us. Not since the minute Horace called us into his office.
And if we return with a Black Volume, he'll just kill us and take it, said Emma. That was his plan anyway.
No, said Julian. That was his plan when he thought he was controlling how we returned. If we decide how and where we return, we can walk into any council meeting and present the Black Volume, bravely rescued from our fairy foes. Horace thought he could get rid of us easily because we were in disgrace. It'll be much harder to do if we return in triumph.
Fine, she said. I get what you think we're doing. I don't know if I agree about working with the Queen, but at least I understand. But you know what would have been better? If you'd included me in the part where you chose what risk we were going to take.
I didn't see the point, he said. You would have worried, and for what?
Emma felt tears burn behind her eyes. This isn't you. You'd never say that.
Julian's eyes flashed.
You know I've always done whatever needed to be done to keep us safe. I thought you understood that about me. This is different. Remember, Julian, remember what Dane said? That you were the kind of guy who would have a girl for a parabatai? She knelt up on the bed, raising her chin to look him directly in the eye. That's what I always loved about you. Even before I was in love with you. You never thought for a second about it diminishing you to have a girl as your warrior partner. You never acted as if I was anything less than your complete equal. You never for a moment made me feel like I had to be weak for you to be strong.
He looked away. Emma pressed on.
You knew we were always stronger together. You've always treated me as though my opinion matters. You've always respected my ability to make decisions for myself. But you're not acting like that now. It's not some small thing that you lied to me, Julian. It's a betrayal of everything we swore in our parabatai ceremony. It's one thing for you not to want to treat me like your girlfriend, but it's entirely another for you not to treat me like your parabatai.
Julian crawled onto the bed beside her. This isn't what I planned, he said. I was concerned that you'd refuse to go to the Seelie Court,
and I was just trying to move fast. The shimmer of the waterfall altered, and Julian's hair was dark again, his lashes making shadows against his cheeks. I had no idea you'd be so upset about everything.
Of course you had no idea.
Having Julian this close made her nerves feel like they were jumping inside her skin. They were both kneeling, facing each other. He was so close she could have reached out and put her arms around him without even needing to lean forward.
You have no idea because you have no feelings. Because you turned off all your emotions, not just about me, but about everything. About Livy, even about Livy. And that's going to come back and bite you in the end.
I don't, he said.
You don't what?
He slid his hand across the bed so that his fingertips touched hers, just barely. Emma's heart kicked into a faster beat.
I don't have no feelings at all.
He sounded lost and a little baffled.
I just don't entirely understand what it is that I do feel. Except that I need you not to be angry, Emma.
She froze. His fingers curved around to stroke the inside of her wrist. Emma felt as if every nerve ending in her body was concentrated there, where his fingers touched. He was touching her pulse, her heart.
I'm sorry, Emma, he said. I'm sorry.
Her heart leapt. With a low cry, she reached out for him on their knees. They wrapped their arms around each other. He dipped his head to kiss her, and all her breath left her body. He tasted the way she imagined fairy fruit would taste, sweeter than any sugar on earth. She was dizzy with the memory of the first time she'd kissed him, wet from seawater, hungry and desperate. This was languorous, hot with slow desire. He explored her mouth thoroughly with his own, stroking his fingertips over her cheekbones, cupping her jaw to tilt her head back. He pulled her closer.
His body still works the same, she thought. Feelings or no feelings.
There was a terrible satisfaction in it. He felt something for her, even if it was only a physical something. But he had said he was sorry. Surely that meant something. Perhaps that the spell was wearing off. Maybe it wasn't permanent. Maybe... He kissed the corner of her mouth, the pulse at her neck. His lips were soft against her throat. His hands caught the hem of her nightgown, working it up her thighs.
Let it happen, her body said. Get whatever you can of him, because there might never be anything else.
His hands were under her gown. He knew where she liked to be touched, knew what would make her shiver and kiss him harder. No one knew her like Julian did. Her eyes fluttered open, her vision hazy with desire. She started. Julian was looking at her, his own eyes open, and the expression in them was cool and thoughtful. It was like a bucket of cold water dashed in her face. She almost gasped. I need you not to be angry, he'd said. His hands were still curved around the backs of her thighs, holding her against him. Against his mouth, she whispered,
You're not really sorry, are you?
His eyes shuddered.
She knew that look. He was thinking of the right thing to say. Not the true thing, but the best thing. The most clever and efficacious thing. The thing that would get him what he wanted and needed.
She had always been proud of him for his cleverness, adored and understood the necessity of it. It was David's slingshot. It was Julian's only small defense against a massive world arrayed against him and his family. It was the only way he knew of protecting what he loved.
But without love as the driving force behind everything he did, what would he be capable of?
A Julian without feelings was a Julian who could and would manipulate anyone, even her. He sank back on his heels, his hands falling to his sides, his expression still indecipherable. Before he could speak, the sound of someone entering the room echoed from downstairs. They scrambled off the bed in alarm.
A few seconds later, they were standing, in some disarray, on the steps leading down to the main room. Neen was there, a key in her hand, looking up at them. She wore the uniform of a Seely Court page. When she caught sight of them, her pale eyebrows raised.
"What does it, human, say? Is this a bad time?"
"It's fine," said Julian. His expression had gone back to normal, as if nothing much had happened. Emma didn't know what her face looked like, but she knew how she felt, as if a gaping hole had been punched through the center of her.
"I'm glad to hear that," Neen said, stalking to the center of the room and turning to face them. "Because we must speak now. Quickly, come downstairs. The Queen has betrayed you, and there is little time to act."
Tavi was finally asleep, clutching a book, his face still stained with recent tears. Mark was kneeling, tousling his soft hair. Helen felt her heart aching, with love for Tavi, with worry, with missing Julian, who would have been able to calm Tavi's fears in minutes, not the hours it was taking Helen. As Mark drew a blanket over his smallest brother, Helen got up to open the window and let some fresh air into the room. She hadn't heard from Julian or Emma since they'd left them behind in Alicante, though Gia swore up and down to Aline that they were all right. And yet Helen had rarely felt so far from her family, even on Wrangell Island, where she had felt cut off from the world. She had trusted that Julian was taking care of them, that they were as happy as they could be, and the images of them happy in her mind had sustained her. The reality of them here was a shock. Without Julian, they were looking to her, and she had no idea for what. Tavi cried when she touched him. Drew glared at her. Ty barely seemed to know she was there. "And Mark, I should never have let them separate us," Helen said, "in Idris. When they wanted to keep Jules and Emma behind, I shouldn't have let them do it."
"The Clave forced it," said Mark, rising to his feet.
"You didn't have a choice."
"We always have choices," said Helen.
"You can't blame yourself. It's very hard to fight Julian when he's being stubborn. He has a very strong will, and he wanted to stay."
"Do you really think so?"
"I think he didn't want to come back with us. He was acting strangely before we left Idris, don't you think?"
"It's hard to say."
Helen shut the window. "Julian has always been able to make sacrifices that were difficult and hide the pain it caused him." "Yes," Mark said. "But even when he was hiding things, he was loving, not cold. Before he left us, he was cold." He spoke simply, without any doubt. He glanced at Tavi again and rose to his feet.
"I have to get back to Kieran. He's hurt, and Tavi is settled."
Helen nodded.
"I will go with you."
The corridors of the Institute were dark and quiet. Somewhere down the hall, Aline was sleeping. Helen let herself think for a moment of how she wanted to crawl back into bed with her wife, curl up to Aline's warmth, and forget everything else.
"Perhaps we could try a Familius rune," said Helen. "Something that would lead us to Julian."
Mark looked puzzled. "You know that will not work over the border with Ferry, and Julian would need to be wearing one, too."
"Of course."
Helen felt as she had years ago when Eleanor Blackthorne had died, as if she had frozen inside and it was difficult to think.
I know that.
Mark gave her a worried look as they entered the spare bedroom where they had put Kieran. The room was dim, and Christina was sitting in a chair beside the bed, holding Kieran's hand. Kieran was very still under the blanket, though his chest rose and fell with the swift, regular breathing normal in fairies. Helen had known only a little about Kieran,